Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast brought to you by ReliaQuest. My name is Chris, and I'm your host this week, where I'm delighted to be in sunny Tampa with two of my colleagues here. So we have Corey and Caroline. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great. It's nice being able to sit across from you and record this episode.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nice to see you. Nice to finally meet you. It's great.
I am not just a talking head on a Teams meeting. You know, I actually do exist in real life. I was saying to someone earlier, you know, you meet people for the first time and, you know, they're taller than you expect or smaller than you. It just kind of takes you by surprise, doesn't it?
Yep.
So we're all here in Tampa in this absolutely glorious building. So this is the first time I've been in the new office. Yeah, really, really fantastic building. Do you want to just explain like what we're doing there this week, Corey?
Yeah, absolutely. So this week is Exponent, and Exponent is a conference that we put on annually here in Tampa, which is our headquarters. And it gives us the opportunity to bring in all of our customers, our partners, our prospects, and do one of several things. Like first, we provide education. So whether that be on threat hunting or operationalizing threat intel or detection philosophies, business email compromise, we just want to ensure that customers, you know, they are the tip of the spear. Like they're up to date with the current threats out there, and they really have a good understanding on them. Something else we try to accomplish is training. So we want to train our customers on our product, which is Grey Matter. We want to make sure that they're using it to its full capabilities. But we also want this opportunity to learn from our customers, whether it be through roundtables or tabletops or panel discussions. Like, what is working well for the customers? Like, what are some hurdles that they had to overcome? Like, what's not working well? And it's really nice being able to sit customers down, you know, with each other, maybe like based on vertical, and just have more of like an intimate discussion. And we also use this opportunity to inform our customers, like on our Grey Matter's roadmap and some of the goals that we're trying to accomplish. And lastly, being able to network, not only us networking with our customers, but our customers networking with each other. I mean, just like you said, you know, you're not just a face on Teams. It's nice being able to talk to you in person and just kind of like pick up on things that you normally lose in translation when it's over some kind of technology.
Good stuff. Yeah. The feedback aspect of this week, I think is the most important thing, because my experience of before I started working for ReliaQuest, and I was on the other end of this, so I was working for a company and we had vendors. Sometimes you almost got the impression that once you've signed on that dotted line, you know, and the onboarding is finished, it just falls off a cliff, that relationship. So having that ongoing relationship where we're able to listen to our customers, take on board their feedback, make improvements where necessary, it is just so important, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of what customers fear is, you know, they get the sales, you know, representatives, and then they sign that dotted line. And then what their fear is, like, they don't continue to receive that same standard across, you know, their contract. So it's nice being able to bring them in, actually getting them in front of like us, you know, some of the experts in the industry and really maintaining that relationship. So really glad we are able to.
And we have an opportunity to show the incredibly talented and intelligent people that we have here at this company. We just have so much talent in this company, and it's really great to be able to show customers that. Of course, you two, that's what I'm talking about. You're the talent right here. That's why we get you on this podcast. You're very intelligent people. Okay, let's start this week's podcast. So we have three topics we're going to cover this week. So the first is related to Google's new AI-powered search generative experience algorithms that recommend scam sites that redirect visitors to unwanted Chrome extensions. So basically, this new AI-powered generative experience has been misappropriated, and we're seeing sort of scammy websites shared with users off the back of this. So quite concerning, I guess. So Caroline, could you clarify exactly, you know, what researchers have found with regards to this? Obviously, I've just mentioned the kind of sort of sites that are coming up, but what exactly did they find?
Yeah, so first of all, we'll go over the Google search generative experience is kind of supposed to be an AI enhancement to their search engine. And basically what it does, it generates a summary of the results that whatever a user searches, and the results come back, it gives you a generated summary along with the several like key links that are below it as well. Just giving you like a pointer, like, hey, this is where we got that information that we're displaying to you. But obviously, AI's response is only good as the data that it's fed. So attackers are using search engine optimization schemes to make sure that their results are put towards the front of whatever Google is going to display to the user. And then this is in turn getting picked up by that LLM and being returned to the user in this new search generative experience. And like you said, Chris, it's mostly scammy sites and referring typically to like your standard giveaway sites. Like here's a new fancy free iPhone because you Googled something.
Wait, that's not real? Because I'm sat here with a broken phone behind me with a screen. Nope. I probably could do with one of those. All right, I won't take them up on that then. That's fine.
No, unfortunately not. okay. Unfortunately, they'll be getting a gift instead, which is your personal information that you submit to Fair have enough. Them send you your imaginary phone.
Okay.
But those are the majority. What they're seeing is a lot of redirects in all of these links that are being presented to the user. So I'm sure if you've ever been on some super ad heavy site and you get a pop up and you see your URL go through like 15 iterations and you're like, where am I ending up? It's pretty much the same kind of activity that is happening here.
I see. I have a very rude phrase I'm not going to say on the podcast, but I'm going to paraphrase it. Maybe Corey has come across this one in his whole career, but rubbish in, rubbish out, like you're feeding the AI nonsense, it's going to provide you with nonsense as well.
Yep.
So obviously we've seen like reports of that. This is one of the first kind of exploitations of AI in this particular manner that I've seen reported on, at least. Have we seen any other kind of cases where a legitimate service, like a language model in this case, has been exploited for these ways or these reasons?
Yeah. So with regards to like Google's product itself, no. I would say it's very much not surprising that their AI search engine or search generative experience is returning these results just because of how we know their regular search engine was also returning malvertising campaigns as well. Yeah. So I don't think it's new for Google. But when it comes to LLMs themselves, I think the concept of intentionally poisoning those models is super interesting. In fact, I was reading a couple months ago about I might have mentioned it on the podcast before, but the University of Chicago is developing a tool called Nightshade, and it's intended to poison the results of image and art generators like Midjourney.
Okay.
So that its intention is for creators to use it themselves to edit their images in a way that when it is fed to an LLM, it kind of scrambles things around a bit. I don't want to get too technical, but then when that's referenced by the LLM, the results are poisoned and it's not the image that they put in it initially. Yeah. So say they drew a picture of a horse, the LLM interprets it as like a hippo, basically.
I'm thinking you could get hacktivists exploiting that, couldn't you, for defacement reasons and things of that nature. So when the user is trying to generate an image of a horse or whatever it might be, then it populates some message related to that hacktivist particular cause. So that's interesting, actually. Go on, Corey.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is this typical SEO poisoning that you think we're dealing with here, or do you think it's different and targeted towards these large language models? And I don't know if you know the answer, just curious.
I don't 100% know the answer, so
no worries.
I might say something completely incorrect, but I think it is the consequence of search engine optimization. I'm not 100% sure if it's specifically targeted for LLMs.
I think it just kind of identifies how permissive search engine optimization poisoning is. It's just so commonplace, isn't it? And even on things like social media, the amount of spammy stuff that gets through the protective measures that are supposed to filter that out, it blows my mind.
Absolutely. And especially with LLM or large language models, it seems like it's going to be even easier to spin up these fake sites and populate them with content, because you can literally just ask it a question and tell it to do something and it'll spit it out. So yeah, definitely interesting. I think from what I was reading, mostly it seems like a lot of these are where they're trying to get you to enable notifications. And then what I thought was really interesting is these notifications would be doing the normal, like, hey, you have malware on your computer, you know, download this. But it was in order to sell security tool license for a commission. Like the one that I referenced was McAfee, and you know, not saying this is associated with them or anything. It's just one tool that these users were using. Mm-hmm. And then obviously going back to the, you got a free iPhone, like using that data that you input to sell, sell that data. So just very interesting.
I did see that vendor get referenced actually, which was bizarre, wasn't it? Yeah, mm-hmm. It's very strange. So another question I'd like to pose to both of you is, can you think of any other risks associated with large language models?
Yeah, something that actually we were just showcasing a little bit here at Exponent and talking through it is how great voice mimicking is getting. Mm-hmm. So you can get someone to talk into a prompt, or maybe you have a recording of them, and then AI and these large language models are able to recreate that voice and try to sell you something to yourself. Mm-hmm. And where I see this really getting abused and like reused is calling in to get your password reset. Mm-hmm. Like they could do that at scale, pre-programmed for probably, you know, very little time and effort on their end, mm-hmm. with a, you know, somewhat chance of success. So we definitely need to start working on preparing the HR teams for a flood of these requests coming in for computers pretending to be people trying to get a password reset or a token or whatever it might
like
be.
Like social engineering, help desks, things like that.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And which we have seen, like, you know, mm-hmm. the ATR that was released today, funny enough, so Tuesday the 26th went out today. There was quite a few cases we talked about in there where help desks were sort of socially engineered, so interesting. What steps should users take when interacting with such services, Caroline? Do you think?
I think for me, the biggest thing is being very conscious of what information you're feeding to an LLM.
Yeah.
Because that once you feed that, the data isn't yours anymore. Okay. So just keeping that in mind is super important, especially in an enterprise environment. So considering, is data exposure to this model like something I should be concerned about? Which in my opinion, yes. but yeah.
That's a really interesting way to put it. Once you feed it into the model, the data isn't yours anymore. Mm-hmm. I really like that.
Yep.
It's gone forever. So yeah, I think that's the key takeaway here, isn't it? It's not giving it anything that's sensitive.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of these companies out there are blocking their users from even visiting. So as much as like they help you from the day to day, do like low brain activity, like really well.
Yeah.
It comes a problem when you're not sanitizing what you're inputting. And if you can't be there to monitor that, then it's going to get taken away.
And you know, users will do it regardless because it makes their life easier, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
If you give them the option, they'll probably abuse it in some way. Okay, fair enough. Let's move on to the second topic of the day. So this is one that Corey highlighted to me earlier this week. So on Friday, March 22nd, one of Spain's high court judges ruled out a temporary ban on the messaging platform Telegram. And I know there has been some developments on this. We'll get onto this in a minute. But however, the same judge suspended the order as it was just about to be enforced. So basically, the U-turn came amid growing criticism among supposed experts in and outside of Spain with regards to this particular decision. So Telegram is obviously an encrypted messaging application used for accessing news and securely communicating. And it just doesn't seem to be a very proportionate decision to block it. So could you just give listeners a bit of a spin, Corey, on like, you know, this decision, why Spain had gone down this route and the sort of ins and outs of what's happened in the last day?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, Friday, Telegram was temporarily suspended. And then yesterday, which was Monday, so the next business day, technically, it was temporarily unsuspended due to a pending report on the impact of the temporary suspension could have on users. Now, for a little bit more context, Telegram is the fourth most used app messaging application in Spain when it has around 8.5 million users, which is approximately 18% of the population.
Blimey.
Now, the problem and kind of how we got here is because media companies were seeing copyrighted content being posted without their permission. Mm. Now, Spain, they did try to go through legal means and contact Telegram officials who were residing in the Virgin Islands to get them to come to court last July and really kind of name drop who were the individuals and what accounts were behind the posting of this pirated content.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, to getting to this point, Telegram didn't show up in court. They haven't really communicated. And it's not too surprising. Like Telegram has already been banned in over a dozen countries. And it seems like their stance is kind of, we are going to just put this program or this platform out there, let users do as they wish, because they're oftentimes in like groups or channels. But like some of these groups can have up to 200,000 individuals in them, which is just kind of insane. So, so that's kind of how we got to where we're at now.
Why are there developers in the Virgin Islands of all places? So that just seems, this alludes to the whole point of them not actually going along with the Spanish officials, and they're just hiding out in the Virgin Islands, couldn't care less.
Yeah.
What's both of your takes on this? Is this proportionate, do you think, at all? Or is this a bit of a sweeping decision that they're probably not going to be able to enforce?
Yeah, it's definitely a tough one, whether it's proportionate or not. So there was a quote in this article, a general secretary said, "It is as if they shut down the internet because there are websites that illegally host content protected by copyright." And I don't think that is exactly a perfect quote to reference what is happening here. I think it's more similar to shutting down Reddit because there was a couple of accounts hosting pirated content. But I think how Reddit would respond is, okay, well, we'll ban these accounts, we'll take it down. Yeah. You know, and I think the problem here is there's zero communication from Telegram and getting this content taken down. So the next step for them really is, well, okay, if Telegram's not helping us, maybe we'll block it. And if we block it, maybe that'll have them reach out to us for to really, you know, get this issue fixed. Mm-hmm. So I think the problem really is there's no real moderation. So Spain tried their legal means and hoping to resolve the issue without taking down the app. But at the end of the day as well, anyone that's really tech savvy could use a VPN.
Exactly.
And you can create an account by just getting a temporary phone number. So that's, you know, allows them to have some level of anonymity.
Okay.
Yeah. And just because a lot of people know that it's so easy to just do that, I feel like Spain knew that, but they still wanted to be like, oh, we're banning your app to get them to play along. So I'm not sure if they ever really intended on like a permanent ban, but more so
like
just to get the pressure.
20% of the population use it though. That is crazy.
Yeah,
18%, right?
18%, which is 8.5 million users. I'm pretty sure they came up to this through like some survey, because I don't know how else they would be able to identify like how if a user created one account or multiple accounts, but yeah,
sure.
18%. Almost one in five.
Blimey. It almost reminds me a little of the kind of crypto exchanges that wouldn't engage in like know your customer related activities. And then you had cyber criminals and other malicious actors kind of using those exchanges to launder money. Mm. And a lot of those crypto exchanges ended up getting banned because they just weren't engaging with the authorities. Mm-hmm. While the likes of like Coinbase, for example, is fine because they hand over everything and you have to prove your identification. But it just kind of reminds me a little of that, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm curious if they're worried of responding because this will like set a precedence. And if you do have to worry about moderation, then I think it might get to when I remember when Elon took over Twitter and he started cutting jobs and then people. X, thank you. Yeah.
And then
people were asking, like, how can you run the company with so few people? And he's like, well, when you're not worried about censorship, then you can actually cut a lot of jobs. So I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening here. And it's not exactly censorship they're concerned about. It's more copyright infringement. But
yeah.
I do imagine you'd have to hire a lot of people to monitor these groups and chats and complaints and whatnot.
There was a really quite well-known UK-based commentator who was talking about X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, the other day, saying that it's just become this haven for like hate speech and stuff needs to be taken down. And he got quite a lot of kickback from people you know, on that particular decision. I know the US is considering, this is what you told me earlier in the week, Corey, a similar move with TikTok. What's the sketch there? What's happening?
Yeah, so actually a bipartisan bill was recently approved at the House level called the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act. This was kind of an overwhelming vote. It was 362-65 to approve the bill. And the bill would really require ByteDance, who's the parent company of TikTok, to sell the social media app or face a ban in all U.S. devices. This does still need to go through the Senate for approval. And I think the real concern, though, is China could gather information on U.S. citizens and control content, which may impact things like elections. It does seem like China has a little bit more control of their populace. We know about the Great Firewall, which is really there to prohibit content which would be like spiritual pollution or sensitive topics. And it's also passed a law in 2021 that requires any business operating in China to report any coding flaws to a government agency before patching the vulnerability or revealing its existence publicly, which just seems a little sketchy. Let's be real.
They have to tell the government before they address the vulnerability.
Yes.
Blimey. Okay. What about like social media in general? So we talked about Telegram, we talked about TikTok, talked about crypto exchanges apparently. Like, how do you feel users should interact with social media as a whole? You know, do you take, I assume you do, but do you take a lot of steps in securing your profiles? Like what do you both do?
Yeah, I would say if you're concerned about your information being gathered, don't bother owning anything that connects to the internet. But yeah, my personal social media is set to private. And my advice to everyone out there, whether it be social media or Roblox, like maybe your kids are playing it, is to open up and view the privacy tab. It's not going to be that many options in there. And you're going to be probably blown away by just things that are enabled by default that you should probably disable. So yeah, that would be my recommendation. It's also kind of tough here because usually the concern is other people using information like your picture or where you're from to as like ammunition against you or maybe your loved ones. But here we're actually concerned about the application gathering metadata on you, and who knows if the settings that you disable or enable actually matter when it comes to them, you know. So that's something I'm curious about.
Is Roblox bad for like sensitive information?
I don't know if it's bad for sensitive information, but I think there's a lot
kind of information they're asking of you if you're signing up to that. Is it just like
email? It's just whether you want your child to be able to like interact with chats or allow friend invites. And if you got someone that's 6 or 7 years old, you probably want to be like discouraging that, you know. So, and also like voice chat, like there are some games where people are right next to each other, like, and they can communicate with your child, and obviously they can be telling your child, "Hey, do this, enable this setting, or blah blah blah." So, yeah, just some of the.
So my son, he's 5, and he sometimes plays video games, but I always make sure he doesn't play online. He only just plays kind of, you know, Crash Bandicoot with me.
Spyro, good old days.
Yeah, Spyro, yeah. So making sure that he doesn't have that connection to the internet, because like you say, you don't want him interacting with other people. Anything you can think of, Caroline, that you do with social media in general? Do you stay off it, or? I know you got a LinkedIn profile, right?
Yeah,
you're always sharing the podcast.
Yeah, the only social media I have that has my full name is my LinkedIn. So everything else I use my first name.
You're almost an outlier in that respect, aren't you? I think that's the best thing to do. I need to delete some of my profiles, I think. I've had Facebook for years, and I was like, do I really need this anymore? I don't know. But let's move on to the last topic, not related to social media. So this is regarding a new vulnerability found on Apple M series and Intel Raptor Lake CPUs. So I'll let Caroline get on to GoFetch shortly, but just to introduce these kind of topic of vulnerabilities overall. So these are part of a series of vulnerabilities affecting speculative execution. So speculative execution is basically a way your operating system kind of manages tasks all at the same time. And there was a series of vulnerabilities. I remember this really, really well back in 2018. For some reason I had 2017 in my head, but it was 2018. The Spectre meltdowns were the original kind of OG vulnerabilities in this space. They exposed fundamental weaknesses in the way processors obviously execute multiple instructions, as I just mentioned, like speculative execution. And As I said, there's been series of these vulnerabilities, and this GoFetch is the kind of latest in these. But yeah, it's been an ongoing problem. We've seen a lot of these kind of issues. Some seem to be more hypothetical in the way that you can exploit them than others. So the original question with Spectrum Meltdown was, do you actually even want to patch this? Because the fix that was provided by Intel and all these kind of other CPU vendors had a demonstrable impact on performance. So the question was, this is going to have a massive impact on how effective your computer runs. And it's very unlikely to be exploited in the first place, but there is that residual tiny risk. So the question was, do you actually go ahead with it? But this GoFetch is another one of these sort of bugs. So I hand the mic over to you, Caroline. You know, is this a hypothetical one or one that we do need to take action on?
I would say currently it's more so on the hypothetical side, the vulnerability as it's been disclosed right now would typically require like some kind of code execution on the target machine in order to abuse the vulnerability in a way that allows them to query secret key information from cryptographic operations. Mm-hmm. So compared to Spectre, this is a bit higher of a barrier to entry.
Okay.
Because back with Spectre, this eventually affected web browser JavaScript engines that were running on vulnerable CPUs. So you could just spin up and host whatever you wanted whenever. So
okay.
It's a bit higher and barrier to entry for this one, I would say.
Okay. So it's harder to exploit than Spectre.
Yes,
okay.
I would say so, yeah.
So very, very unlikely to be exploited from the sounds of it.
But actually, can I add a caveat with
yes,
that?
Yes.
Because from my understanding, and I wasn't around for Spectre, but from what I understand is the initial disclosures around Spectre were kind of around the same way,
yeah.
Where it was like, this is very difficult to exploit. And then eventually they moved to being able to utilize a web browser JavaScript engine so that it became more serious once
sure.
That was released, I believe, by Google or Mandiant.
Sure.
So yeah.
Interesting. So I wanted to get both of your takes on like patching and general risk appetite. So obviously we always talk about vulnerabilities on this podcast. We had another one named by our favorite vendor this week that we didn't choose to mention, but it was another critical vulnerability that was being exploited in the wild. But we obviously already, we usually talk about patching as soon as possible. Timeliness is key, crucial. Threat actors are exploiting these in no time at all. You know, it's just getting so much, it's getting so much more important that you address these issues in a timely fashion. But that being said, is there some cases that you see where you wouldn't roll out patches immediately? And what would those cases be?
Yeah, I can probably start with this one. So yeah. I think it depends first on the type of patch,
excuse me,
as well as your risk tolerance. Like, is it a patch that's just enabling a new feature, or are you patching drivers? Mm-hmm. If in those circumstances, you probably have more time to consider and analyze the impact on your systems mm-hmm. by using like a small target set. And then that's relatively low risk. Is it a security patch, on the other hand, which is going to be more time sensitive, mm-hmm. of course? And then what is the risk associated there? Like, can it be abused by an unauthenticated attacker? What is the level of knowledge and skill required to abuse the vulnerability? This is definitely one reason why people get so upset when technical details on exploiting a vulnerability are released at the same time, or even before a patch is released, is because it just lowers the barrier of entry so much.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also like the question, like, is this already being mitigated by other defenses that I already have deployed?
Yeah.
I think you can answer a lot of these questions by, or prepare yourself to answer a lot of these questions by developing a good patch management policy. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to want to test patches prior to deployment. You're going to want to monitor the patching process and even have a rollback plan. So not an easy answer. Yeah. I think you should definitely have a patch management policy that really clearly defines your risk tolerance and some questions mm-hmm. that should be asked just to kind of like verify whether you need to go through with this rather immediately mm-hmm. or you have a little bit more time to consider.
So the answer is it depends pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, of course. It's never an easy answer.
Unfortunately, these kinds of environments are very complex and you just never know. So
Fair enough. Yeah, the rollback thing, that's interesting. Like, how would that work? I've never been involved in a rollback of a patch. Like, is it easy to achieve?
I'll be honest, I'm not 100%. It's not my typical day-to-day. Okay. I imagine it can go a number of ways, whether you have, you're using a patch management solution, or maybe you're going like pushing patches through SCCM. Maybe that might provide the ability to roll back if things go south. Also, it's always recommended to start on like a small number of systems. Yeah. And on those small number of systems, hopefully you would have a backup applied right prior to that patch getting applied. So if it does go bad, you know, at least it's a relatively small target set, and then you have the capability to roll that back.
You're not going to roll it out immediately to your crown jewels. You're going to start with a small subset of systems and then see how that goes. And then obviously if it breaks your devices, then you can achieve those rollbacks. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that is pretty much the content that we had lined up for the podcast this week. I just want to say a big thank you to Corey and Caroline for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Great
to have you on, honestly. We have this beautiful view just across Tampa at the moment. We're on the 17th floor, right?
Yep.
It's absolutely beautiful up here. It really is a great day. If you like the podcast, if you found this insightful, by all means, give us a like, a subscribe on your respective podcasting platform. If you have any feedback for the podcast, you can send that through to shadowtalk@reliquest.com. We're always happy to receive feedback. Other than that, stay safe and we'll see you next week.